Hello, everybody.
Hi, everyone.
Welcome back.
Welcome back to the... Sorry. Let me try that again.
Start again.
Sorry. Hello. Welcome back to the Push Podcast.
Welcome back.
My name is Sydney. I am a labor and delivery nurse. For those of you who don't know, I also share educational content online at nurse_Sydney. So on TikTok, Instagram, all that kind of stuff, kind of birth education role. And then this is my cousin, Megan.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Megan McGrattan. I'm an OBGYN here in Toronto. I'm also a minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon and a clinical researcher, as well as a new mom.
A new mom.
So we have had so many new followers join us, I think, since the last time we filmed episodes.
Yes.
So because Sydney and I obviously have big clinical schedules ourselves, we tend to bulk film, you know, a few episodes at a time.
Exactly.
And a lot has changed since we were last sitting here.
So much has changed. We have so many new followers across platforms, so many new listeners. So thank you guys. Thank you so much. It means the world to us.
Yep.
We are so happy you're here and continuing to listen. And hopefully we can provide you with some more resources to help you be able to advocate for yourself better. That's ultimately why we decided to start the Push Podcast. And we are just so happy it's going well and that you guys enjoying it.
So happy, so overwhelmed. I'm sure for Sid, I'm sure this is somewhat expected for you. And you did warn me that this had the potential to go very well.
Yes.
I have no background in social media. And so exactly. I just kind of thought, you know, if five people listen and it's helpful, then at the very least it was, you know, we put some good into the world and we did something fun together.
Yep.
But the response has just been really overwhelming in the best of ways for me. And so thank you guys all for coming along on this journey with us. It's really exciting and we're really happy that you're here.
Yes. And we worked out the kinks, the technology kinks with like camera equipment and audio and all that kind of stuff. So I feel like we're finally getting into a rhythm of like how to actually do a proper podcast.
I think so too. And for those of you who are watching on YouTube, you can finally see my face. I have learned to not hide behind the
The microphone with that. We learned that, you know, trial and error. Oops.
Yeah.
So you can see us now. You can see us in our beautiful matching scrubs from Garden Malad.
Yes.
Look at these. They're so cute. So they actually have our names embroidered on them and the Push Podcast for those of you on YouTube who can actually see. They are so cute. So thank you, Garden Malad. I've worked with them for years now and they are an amazing Canadian scrub company. They're so comfortable. Like you were even saying that you were feeling like they were very comfortable today when you put them on for the first time.
Yeah, they are really comfortable. And I'm realizing as well, as I looked over at my own custom embroidery, that I'm additionally sporting a little bit of a toothpaste stain from Baby Sam.
Well, hey, real life.
Which, you know what, is just a real life element of
this. She had to go brush Sammy's teeth before he went to bed, and now we're filming this episode.
My husband brushes his teeth, and that's fine. So if you're ordering from Garden Malad, please know that they do not come with a toothpaste stain. That was DIY on Sam's side of things.
Yes.
I have to say, Sid, this is my first pair of Garden Malad scrubs. I have other pairs of scrubs from multiple different companies, and I really love how lightweight they are.
Yes.
They feel very comfortable. They feel very stretchy.
Yep.
But they also just don't feel heavy or cumbersome. And especially for us on labor and delivery, that's certainly something that we look for even in clinic because we often are running around and trying to do a lot of different things at once.
Exactly. So you can get warm and you want things that are breathable, lightweight. Yep. I find that they also are pretty wrinkle resistant too. Like I find if I take it out of a drawer and it has a couple wrinkles, after like an hour of wearing it, the wrinkles have come out, which is nice. And they come in a variety of different sizes. We love size inclusivity and also styles. So they have like tall length joggers, which is really good for people like me who are tall. And then there's also petites as well. And we have the straight legs, the joggers, all kinds of stuff. So if you guys are curious and want to check out Garden Malad, they have a bunch of beautiful scrubs, lots mm-hmm. of beautiful colors. We're wearing the navy, but there's so many colors online and they come out with like a new color or two every month, which yeah. I love. So yes,
thank you, Garde Malade.
Yeah, thank you. We will continue to wear our Garde Malade scrubs on the Fush podcast.
Custom Garde Malade scrubs.
Yes.
we're always happy to partner with another Canadian brand.
Yes.
And yeah, thank you, Garde Malade, for being a friend of the Fush podcast and for the scrubs. Uh-huh. All right. So Sydney, what are we talking about today?
Yes, today, one of my like favorite topics. I feel like I've said that a couple times throughout the Fush podcast, but we're going to be talking about birth plans, which I love birth plans. And I know there's a lot of misconceptions online that care providers don't like birth plans. So we are going to debunk some of those myths. We're going to talk about what you should have on your birth plan, what you shouldn't have on your birth plan, and where the birth plan originated from, and all that good stuff. So, yeah.
Come along with us to unpack all of this and also to start to talk about what things they get right and what things they get wrong or where we could stand to improve.
Exactly. Because there's a lot of things online too that show, you know, the perfect birth and you need to have all these things listed out on your birth plan so that your birth goes seamlessly. And, you know, we're going to talk about what that actually looks like because in my humble opinion, there's no such thing as a perfect birth.
I would definitely tend to agree with that. Yeah. But let's back up for 1 second.
Yes.
Said, if I'm somebody who is like maybe like freshly pregnant, maybe is not even thinking about conceiving yet, but interested in all of this, all of these topics in this world, what is a birth plan? What's our practical definition?
Yeah. So it's basically just a list, a written list, either written by hand or on the computer, or there's all these fancy templates you can buy online nowadays, but it's just a list of your preferences. So what preferences do you have for birth, if any? And usually I find it's a good list that you can look at ahead of time to actually even figure out what your preferences are. Because sometimes you don't even know what your preferences are until you're sitting down and actually researching the topics and things that you should include on your birth plan. And that's the thing I actually like the most about birth plans is it just gives you and your birth partner a chance to sit down and be like, what do we actually want? Because you do have a lot of choice and a lot of autonomy when it comes to delivering your baby and how you deliver your baby. So that's all a birth plan is, a list of your wishes, a roadmap, a guide.
What a nice point too, in that like it helps people explore what labor and delivery actually looks like.
Yes.
I feel like as birth has kind of modernized over the last several hundred years, kind of two things have simultaneously occurred, right? Number one, birth has largely moved out of the home, although of course home births still happen and exist, particularly under the care of registered midwives. But it's moved kind of out of the home, out of the hands of like women and family and communities where historically birth was kind of taking place, and into hospital centers, right?
Yeah.
Where a lot of the decision making is now institutionalized, right?
Yes.
And the other thing that's happened too is as our understanding of obstetrical medicine has expanded, right? As we've actually turned our brains and turned our academic work to achieving, you know, more, you know, safer, healthier pregnancies and birthing processes, I think as well, the options have expanded, right?
So time.
Far more things are available to us than were, you know, historically. And so that's, but all that to say, I think it's made it a much more confusing, much more intimidating process, I think, for women who are just starting this.
Yes. And that's kind of where the birth plan has come in, is to kind of reduce that anxiety, that confusion, and make you feel a little bit more prepared when you're going when you're going in to deliver your baby at the hospital or birthing center, right? So,
Amazing. Well, I'm sure both of us have seen lots of patients walk in with a paper birth plan in hand. But I was kind of interested as to when this even started, because as long as I've been practicing, it's been a thing that people have done. Although I do have to say, over the last few years, I've certainly seen far more birth plans than I saw when I was first starting out.
Yeah.
So as far as I can figure, although there's no, you know, historical narrative of the birth plan that I was easily able to cull.
To find.
It seems to have gathered its roots in a lot of the natural childbirth movement that started kind of in the 1960s and the 1970s in North America and Europe. Some of the advocates of that movement would be people like Fernand Lamaze of the Lamaze technique, that really popularized the concept that birth should be less medicalized and that women should have more say in the process, right? At that time as well, second wave feminism was intersecting with critiques of the obstetrical practice at the time, which was much heavier than now on the use of things like routine episiotomy, heavy sedation during deliveries, restricted mobility, and paternalism in general with respect to decision-making about obstetrical care. And so through that, the idea that patients should be able to be the drivers of their own care in as much as is safe and appropriate, I think, was becoming a lot more popularized. Yeah. And the first reference to a written birth plan that I could find was in a document that was developed in 1980 called Planning Your Baby's Birth, that was published by the International Childbirth Education Association in Minneapolis in Minnesota. And so it sounds like after that, this concept of like writing down the things that you would want really took storm. Through the 80s and 90s, we saw this concept more and more be present and popularized, both with respect to media as well as in practice in hospitals. And this written template format, as we've come to understand it, the checklists and forms for intervention, pain relief, things like that, started to appear in educational centers as well, right? Childbirth classes, parenting magazines, and
social media too.
In our generation, social media, right? So Sydney, I'm sure you've seen some misconceptions around how this can be introduced and incorporated into modern birthing practices as well, especially on social media. What sorts of things have you heard and seen and talked about with some of your followers?
I mean, it's kind of split. I think birth plans, like some people online see it as very empowering and something that, you know, everyone should do, and you should have everything listed out, because if you don't have a birth plan, you know, your provider might not listen to you, blah, blah, blah. And then there's also people who say that they are completely pointless. And, you know, the only birth plan they want is to be healthy, like a healthy mom, healthy baby. And as much as I agree with that, that is ultimately our goal, is for you to be healthy and for your baby to be healthy. For some people, and not everyone, it's also okay if that's not you. For some people, there's more to the birth process than just making sure you come out of it happy, healthy, and alive. And there's lots of aspects that go into birth that are important to consider. Again, for some people, not everyone. Some people don't want to know anything, and that's okay too. So take what you will from this episode and see about like what fits for you and what doesn't fit for you. I think that's the best thing I can recommend, because there's so many people online who talk about exactly what they put on their birth plan, and those things truly might not fit with you and your birth plan that you have for yourself and your family. So it's hard, because there's a lot online. Like, you're going to find everything. You're going to find people who hate birth plans. You're going to find people who absolutely love them. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, it's just making sure that you're finding something that, that works best for you.
I think that, that concept is really popularized too on, especially amongst providers, right? This idea that the best birth plan is like healthy mom, happy baby, right? Which is obviously true, right? I don't think that there are many people that would argue with that. But I think it's also fair. There's a lot of criticism of that mentality, in the sense that that really is, if that is the standard, the bar is on the ground. That's not to say that complications don't occur, right? That's not to say that sometimes really the best that we can do is to ensure healthy mom, healthy baby, right? But I do think it's very fair to say we should aim for more, right? As with so many things, I think in labor and delivery and in obstetrical care, we get kind of cornered into these discussions where it's either or, right? Yes. It's like either you do a birth plan and like you're against your providers or all you care about is happy, like healthy mom, healthy baby.
Yeah.
And it's not either or, it's and.
Yes, it's and, exactly.
It's and. And there's room for all of us and there's discussion. There's room for all of these perspectives.
Yep.
But before we delve too much into kind of all of the controversy surrounding some elements of birth plans or their institutionalization in the first place.
Yeah.
Sid, what are the kind of things that people tend to put on their birth plan?
Yeah.
Like what elements are we talking about here?
Yes. So we are talking about delivery and then also postpartum. I find a lot of people forget about postpartum stuff on there. And then anything to do with baby. So feeding, how you want to feed your baby. Do you want to do formula? Do you want to do breastfeeding? Do you want to bath your baby in the first 24 hours or after? Do you want your baby to be circumcised or not? Yeah. Do you want vitamin K and erythromycin eye ointment on baby or not? Like all of those things that you need to think about and that the hospital will ask you once you are admitted. Mm-hmm. These are just things you can think about ahead of time. And then obviously during birth, we're talking about pain management. That's a huge one that some people actually don't prepare for, but you should have an idea of what options are available to you.
Yeah.
So epidural, no epidural. Do you want to do sterile water injections? Do you want to use the nitrous oxide or the laughing gas? Are you interested in using like a morphine and Gravol combination, like an injection in your leg, a PCA pump? There's all kinds of stuff that you can look into for pain management. And I think it's a good thing to look into ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, are you okay with oxytocin or Pitocin being used? Sorry. For those of you who are listening in the US, in Canada, we do use the word oxytocin, which I get a lot of controversy online when I say oxytocin and not Pitocin. But in Canada, we do reference it as oxytocin or Pitocin. We say both. Mm-hmm. But I am talking about the synthetic form, Pitocin. Mm-hmm. So if you're okay with using Pitocin for augmentation or induction of labor, what forms of induction of labor you're referring to or you're comfortable with. And a lot of these things can also be brought up at your prenatal appointments too, and probably will be if they're considering induction for some reason. You probably will have spoken to your OBGYN or midwife about these things ahead of time. But there's so many things. What are some other things you can think about?
So certainly from the clinical side of things, I think once people are in labor, and you're right to say that birth plans don't just include like birth specifically, right?
Yeah.
It can include anything about like your admission process. Yeah. It can include the way that you would like us to communicate with you during the course of a labor.
Yeah.
It can include your monitoring preferences, right? So do you prefer, if possible, to have intermittent monitoring of baby's heartbeat during the labor process? Or are you okay with continuous monitoring?
Yeah.
Your preferences with respect to things like forceps or vacuum delivery. Mm-hmm. And then I think something that people forget as well, I think there's a perspective that birth plans and planning and thinking about your birth and the options that might be available to you is something that's really limited to kind of the most natural, crunchy delivery that you can possibly have, which is not true, right? Like it's totally fine to have a birth plan that says like, I would like interventions when they are indicated,
you
right?
You can have a birth plan for a C-section.
That is exactly what I was going to say. There are lots of ways to really like tailor a C-section.
Yes.
Especially an elective C-section, to be honest with you. If it's a scheduled C-section, there's a lot of ways that we can make that feel really special. And I actually, as a provider, take like a lot of pleasure in doing things like talking to the patient in anesthesia about saying, would you like us to drop the drape? So there's a drape that extends from your chest to up towards the ceiling during a C-section that separates what you can see from what we're doing and our operative field, in part for sterility, also in part because most people don't want to watch their own surgery.
Yes.
But at the time that we're delivering baby, we can actually lower that drape with the help of our anesthetist.
And there's some clear drapes, Some places have
clear drapes so that you can actually see baby being delivered.
Yep.
Yep. And that's a way to make that really a special process for people as well.
Yeah. There's so many things with C-sections. I can think like doing skin to skin in the OR too is another
possible,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah. If applicable. And then what else? Oh, music. If you want music played in the OR, that's sometimes something we can work into your operation as well. There's so many things that you could think about. So I'm a huge advocate for C-sections, having a C-section birth plan as well.
Yeah. Ways to make, I mean, similar for anybody who's listened to our mini episodes on what to pack in your hospital bag.
Yes.
I think they're in a similar vein, like many of the things that you would bring really are just about making you feel comfortable.
Yes.
They're less about safety, more about comfort, right? And making you feel that this is a process where you like can be at home, can enjoy it, can take it in as much as you're able to.
Yeah.
And I think birth plans are really similar, right? Oh, yeah. In that, especially for even these more medicalized births, right? To make it still feel like something that is creating that special moment for you and your birth partner and your baby, whatever that may look like for you.
And still giving you a little bit of a sense of control, even though, you know, you can't perform the surgery yourself. It's still giving you that ability to pick and choose what you want for you and your baby during that time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, I do think as we've talked about all these different options and truly, we have only scratched the surface. I don't think it's possible, especially in a presentation type way like this without like visuals.
Yes.
To really and truly explain all of the different things that could be discussed with respect to how someone moves through the birthing process.
Yeah.
So first of all, do not feel stressed or overwhelmed if you're just starting this and you're like, oh my God, I didn't even know that I could have choices.
Yeah.
Where Sydney and I practice in Canada, I do have to say the vast majority of elements on a birth plan, at least most commercially available marketed birth plans, are standard of care in Canada.
Yeah.
So most of the things that you would request are things that we would automatically do anyway.
100%.
And so we are obviously super happy to accommodate because in fact, many of our systems are built around those things, both to protect mom and baby safety, as well as to, you know, ensure as much of a positive experience as we can.
Yeah. And so, following best practice guidelines and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So if it fits best for your own perspective, your mental health, to rock in with no physical birth plan, know that much of this is actually standard of care as well.
Most of the stuff we will actually go over with you when you are admitted or in triage. Yeah. So, you know, we have a big admission sheet that we go through that usually has a lot of these things like, do you want to do delayed cord clamping or not? Do you want to breastfeed? Do you want to bottle feed? Who is going to be your main support person? Do you want an epidural? We go through all of those already. And I mean, it's not a bad thing to have a birth plan. Sometimes if someone has a paper birth plan that they hand to me, I can quickly look through it so I don't have to ask them again and be repetitive. But at the same time, if you don't come with a paper birth plan that lays all those things out, I'm just going to ask you, we're just going to have a conversation at that time. So it's no biggie.
So Sydney.
Yes.
From the bedside, what are some things that you find are challenges or roadblocks in adapting people's birth plans or in navigating birth plans in general?
In general. Yes. So the main thing I would say is having a very detailed, very, very detailed, like we're talking like 3+ page birth plan. That's a little bit challenging because I will look through the entire birth plan. I will look through the 5-10 page birth plan. Absolutely. But will everyone have the time who's taking care of you to read through that plan and to see everything and to memorize it for your care? Probably not.
Yeah.
So saying that, I mean, I wish we could, but that's probably not going to happen. I would say keeping things simple, clear, and concise is your best bet. Okay. So I love when my patients also have already brought the birth plan up to their provider ahead of time.
Yeah.
That can be really helpful. So instead of just, obviously you can bring your birth plan into triage with you, but if you have mentioned some of these things or given it to your provider ahead of time, sometimes we can even have a copy of it in your chart already. Mm-hmm. If you're coming for an induction or something like that, we already have it so we can look through it before you even arrive. Mm-hmm. That's lovely. And then the other thing I would say is just having very unrealistic expectations. Mm-hmm. So something that maybe your hospital doesn't even offer. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, I've seen some things I've seen on birth plans before that our hospital hasn't even had is something like a walking epidural. You know, mm-hmm. some facilities offer that, but mm-hmm. the facility I currently work at, we don't offer that. So, you know, doing your research a little bit ahead of time, asking those questions ahead of time will be helpful so that you're not coming in and have those things on your birth plan. And then we have to be, you know, the bearer of bad news and be like, so I saw this was on your birth plan. We actually can't provide that.
Yeah.
And that might happen anyways with some things. So just keep that in mind. But that's the point of the birth plan as well, is to have those conversations and be like, we can't offer you this, but here's an alternative that might be something you'd be interested in. And then you can have that conversation ahead of time. What becomes challenging again is if you are in very active labor and you're trying to go through your entire 5-6 page birth plan with your providers at that time, that can be very challenging because you're in pain, you're in labor, you're in your labor bubble where nothing past your hand you can focus on truly, right? So that's why, again, I always say, build your birth plan with a birth partner, whoever you're planning to have with you, whether that's your mom, your sister, your husband, your wife, whoever it is, have them there, walk through the birth plan with them so that they can advocate for you on your behalf as well. And then bring it up with your care team ahead of time, if possible.
I would agree with that. And I mean, it sounds like the birth plan and the exercise, I think, of creating a birth plan at its like purest form is a way for people to begin to engage in the things that can happen, that can be an option for them in the course of a delivery, especially for someone like a first-time mom or someone delivering at a new facility for the first time, that might allow you to feel as though some of the unknowns are accounted for, right? Because I think a lot of the fear surrounding birth is really rooted in fear of the unknown, right? And I think conversely, again, this is a not, this is another circumstance where it's not either or, it's and. A lot of providers will feel sometimes, like from our perspective, you know, a knee-jerk reaction that like birth is inherently unpredictable, right? And so birth plans can sometimes give the illusion of control, I think, where it may not exist. And so being able to create a plan that allows you to feel as though you've accounted for those unknowns in some way, right? While also having it there without our hands tightly wrapped around it, knowing that we are letting go of control a bit in this process, I think is probably the middle ground, the and, that allows this to be like an unequivocally positive experience. And certainly from the research side of things and from the physician side of things as well, I think sometimes we something we fear about birth plans or when people have really stringent, really detailed birth plans is the risk of disappointment, right? And of people feeling very, you know, feeling shame, feeling, you know, grief about their delivery not going the way that they had planned,
which
right?
can lead to birth trauma too.
Of course.
I want to just briefly mention one of my close friends, Tina, mom and nurse Tina. She does amazing work on how to prevent birth trauma. And I think, you know, having some of those expectations and making them, thinking about them ahead of time and thinking about what's truly important to you and what would be like your go-to ones that you're like, okay, this is a non-negotiable, whereas other ones, I understand this might change and I'm okay with that.
What are the nice to haves? What are the true necessities in order for you to feel safe?
Exactly. Right? Which will hopefully your team will be able to like be able to accommodate and then hopefully prevent any birth trauma from happening.
Yeah. And you know what? I think that this is something that all of us can agree on as well. There was a 2013 study in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology of Canada, our very own JOGC, that actually found that both providers and patients responded in almost identical numbers when polled on what were some of the disadvantages of birth plans? Mm-hmm. And both felt that the greatest disadvantage was negative emotions such as disappointment when a birth plan was not followed. Mm-hmm. So I think as we kind of discuss back and forth, while sometimes it feels that there's pull and push with respect to, are these positive? How can they be implemented? You know, what? Where do we come from on either side in you know, creating and adhering to these plans, is that really we're focused on the same thing at the end of the day, which is safety and experience, right? So 43% of patients and 47% of providers, so again, near identical, felt that the risk of disappointment was the thing that they were most concerned about in creating birth plans, particularly very detailed birth plans. And so I think this is where I hope that maybe that like insight for both of us into what each side is thinking will allow for better communication around birth plans in general and you know, allow us to adopt them a little bit more.
Yeah.
More thoughtfully, more right?
Thoughtfully, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so getting into the research a little bit.
Yeah.
Sid, there is some like interesting evidence surrounding when birth plans are implemented, right?
Okay. Yeah.
What's your perspective on the patient experience based on the evidence?
Yeah. So birth plans specifically, so the World Health Organization actually stated that birth plans need to be individualized according to needs and preferences, and that birth plans actually they're a supportive tool for physiological birth and respectful care, which I think is really cool. So it's actually, the evidence suggests that birth plans are something that is going to help patients and birthing people feel more empowered and more that the care can be tailored specifically to them, which I love. So in the nursing literature, so birth plans are shown to overall in a lot of evidence is shown to improve satisfaction amongst patients, which I think comes from, you know, an increased sense of control, which we've talked about. And this is, I will say in the research, it does say when birth plans are flexible and they aren't overly detailed. Mm-hmm. So that kind of goes back to that, having the 3+ birth page birth plan with so many details in it. The evidence actually shows that if it is super long, it will lead to patients being dissatisfied with the care that they receive, which is interesting. So again, keep it simple, keep it, you know, make sure you know what your non-negotiables are and include those in there, because ultimately it will lead to you feeling more satisfied and more in control of your care and your birth, which is important.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading similar things, Sydney. And I think what's really interesting as well is very in line with what we've discussed already with respect to a birth plan being a tool, right? And not a plan in and of itself. Perhaps like birth plan is like the wrong term for what what we're creating really.
Yeah.
But it's a tool to open communication, to learn more about the birthing process, to have good conversations with your team and your provider about what might be appropriate for you, right?
Yeah.
And what might be available in your center.
Yeah.
As opposed to kind of the play-by-play for how we expect delivery to go.
Because that's not going to happen.
No, truly. Exactly.
Most likely it won't.
For those who are able to access it, I'm not sure how freely accessible it is, but the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology published a couple of years back an expert review on birth plans and on the literature surrounding them. And so it's a really great overall review, but they also quoted a study that found that when birth plans were overly detailed, they did see an association with about an 80% reduction in overall satisfaction with the birth. And so again, I think that does speak to expectations and how we manage them as a team, right?
Yeah.
And the best use of a birth plan being as like a communication tool as opposed to a literal plan for delivery.
Yeah. It's more of a birth preference list, if you will. I think Jen Hamilton, she calls it something. Oh gosh, I'm going to have to look that up. What?
We'll insert it here.
We'll insert it. She calls the birth plan something, and it's so creative, and it's so fitting, because plan is maybe not the best
word. Plan is maybe not the right word. As with so many things, like perhaps we have to like sit back and re evaluate like what the tools that we're using actually are, right? And like how we're using them.
Exactly.
So something I found was interesting. I was not surprised to see that there was literature surrounding the experience of birth plans, both for patients and providers. Mm-hmm. But I actually didn't expect to see in my research for this episode that there's actually some evidence to show whether birth plan changes like clinical outcomes, right? So what actually rolls out in your delivery, irrespective of how you feel about it. And I will say, the evidence isn't super strong. So we don't have like a ton of research on this, but there are some interesting trends that have been noted. So there's a 2020 case control study out of Spain that basically showed that there was no substantial difference in the length of the second stage of labor associated with a patient having a birth plan or not. So that's basically how long someone was pushing. But the mean time for the first stage of labor, so that early process, was approximately 1 hour longer for the birth plan group than the plan, the group without a plan. However, a 2018 prospective cohort found no difference in that time. And again, I think that kind of references as well the importance of communication and how we communicate about things may impact someone's delivery. It's hard for us to assess, and I'll be honest, I didn't critically appraise either of these specific studies myself. But it's possible that, you know, the way that we're talking about things like augmentation, the way that we're talking about things like intervention may influence somebody, you know, whether they have a birth plan or not. There was also a really interesting, actually, retrospective cross-sectional study out of Los Angeles. I believe it was UCLA. That was published in 2017 that looked at 14,000 patients. So important to note, as we're kind of like tiptoeing into like basics of critical appraisal with everybody who doesn't have, you know, an academic medical background. A retrospective study means that we're not like enrolling patients and telling them about the study and saying you're going to have some choices as we go forward. We are looking back through our charts to say, okay, we're looking at a particular outcome, what happened, right? Like, and what can we associate with that? So by definition, it's less, it maybe is sometimes less specific or less accurate than a study that we're like designing moving forward, right? Because we're looking back trying to say like what happened. But 14,000 patients is a lot of patients. And what they found was that a birth plan, having a birth plan, or attending a birth class was associated with a lower cesarean delivery rate than not having a birth plan. And what I think is really interesting, so this study I did pull up and read the entire thing and read it in detail. And what was cool about this study is that it's really easy to sit back and to hear that stat and to say, okay, well, there's so many factors that go into whether someone has a cesarean delivery or not. So they actually adjusted for patient factors as well, right? To say, what were the characteristics of the birth plan group versus the non-birth plan group and adjust it so that they were as similar as possible. And they found that this trend persisted. And then they also looked just at first-time deliveries, right? Because again, we don't necessarily know whether somebody's going to be able to deliver vaginally easily until we have tried. And again, they found that even when they stratified just to patients for whom this was their first delivery, the trend persisted. And so I think what they kind of concluded in their discussion section was that this is a birth education tool, right? And that this may actually, this enhanced birth preparedness really may impact someone's desire or commitment to persist with a vaginal delivery, which ultimately is a good thing. Now, there were some limitations to the study by virtue of being done at a like very, like academic medical center in Los Angeles, California, right? Our populations are not the same everywhere, right? Even within a particular country. And they did find that this group was predominantly white and predominantly lower BMI, right? And we know that race can impact someone's experience of delivery, right? As well as BMI, right? For reasons that are medical and also some reasons that are more social and socioeconomic. And that was really not accounted for in this study. And again, then the study was also retrospective. So it's really hard to say whether provider preference, like how much role provider preference played. Yep. They weren't able to like tailor the script with which someone might discuss things yeah. like interventions to try and make the groups as similar as possible. And so yep. it's really hard to assess the impact of that. But again, I think the overarching lesson that like birth preparedness, right?
Yeah.
Can have a really positive impact on someone's mode of delivery.
Absolutely.
Is something that, you know, anecdotally or intuitively we feel must be true.
Yeah.
And it's really heartening to see that that has been given some teeth in the literature with respect to this study.
And if you guys are going to take anything away from this mm-hmm. episode, if you're finding it, if you're sitting here and you're like, oh my gosh, this is so overwhelming. I'm hearing that I should have a birth plan, but what the heck do I put on it? This is too much. Like, I get it. Take a deep breath.
Yeah.
You're okay. Like, we're going to figure this out. My number one advice is to attend a birth class, like mm-hmm. Some kind of program. Usually most hospitals provide them for free. And you can also pay for birth classes. But this will be able to help you so much in that birth preparedness, right? Yeah. So learning all the things you need to know ahead of time so that when you actually get to birthing your baby, these things are a little bit more familiar for you. And then ultimately we're here to guide you to be able to make those decisions for yourself properly. But being a little bit more prepared will, I think, increase your satisfaction. And it will also hopefully increase your ability to have the birth that you want.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And have quote unquote better outcomes, right?
Yeah.
So, anyways.
No, I totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
And on that very, you know, happy note.
Yes.
Can we buckle up and get a little bit controversial here?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about some of the specific elements on birth plans.
Yes.
That I see, and I know you see because we talked about this before we built this episode, but that we see on social media and people really having some debates and disagreements over.
Yes, yes. I really want to dive into these ones. And especially with you too, because I think sometimes OBs specifically get a little bit of a bad rap with birth plans. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, well, all OBs hate birth plans because it, like I've actually heard some people say that if you have a birth plan, it's you're automatically gonna have a C-section.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is horrible. That is very untrue. But I've heard providers say that.
Well, and clearly that's not what the evidence shows.
Exactly.
I feel like when we say things like that or when we talk about things like that, like at the nursing station altogether, there is a little bit of a sense sometimes. We're very superstitious people in spite of being, you know, very evidence-based in many centers. Yeah. And so I think there's a sense sometimes that like the more you plan for something, the more likely it is
it
to
won't
go awry.
It won't go
like the best laid plans kind of situation.
Exactly.
But you're right. I do think that there is a sense that we can't talk about these things. And and from my perspective, I can't speak for every OB, but the only thing that gets my back up about a birth plan is, well, number one, I would say, is if the information with which somebody has been given to build it, I feel is
incorrect.
Good quality, right? Yeah. Because I feel really strongly that like you can make a decision that I disagree with. I have honestly, ultimately no problem with that. But I really strongly feel that you deserve to be empowered with good information.
Absolutely.
And that is where I get my backup sometimes with respect to some birth plan elements. Yep. And then the second thing is I don't like my patients to be set up for what I feel is disappointment if in the context of like an overly rigid or overly detailed birth plan.
Yes.
But that is ultimately also not is a little bit paternalistic of me to I would never prevent somebody from doing that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
If that's what they felt, even if I felt that it was, you know, we were sure to be unable to accommodate every single request, you know?
Yeah. But let's go over what those things are that those kind of red
the
underlined
controversial ones.
Yeah. What are the things that when you read that on a birth plan, you're like, okay, I'm going to have to go and have a conversation about this with the patient. And again, we're not from a judgmental perspective.
No.
Sometimes it's just these things are you see online and you add it to your birth plan because that's what someone told you to put on it. It's not necessarily because you like, so that's why we have these conversations, but let's talk about them. What are they and why?
So the very first one that jumped to my mind that I find I have to unpack a lot with people is the concept of an episiotomy.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So episiotomies, for people who haven't heard of them before, are a cut that we might make at the back of the vagina in order to ultimately facilitate delivery in a safe and effective manner, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of birth plans, I think actually almost every birth plan I've ever seen has said no episiotomy. And the truth is I do an episiotomy extremely rarely, right?
Yep.
And so let's talk about a little bit some of the times when I would recommend one, because I spend a lot of time when I'm able to counseling people around when I might recommend an episiotomy, even that if that's not a really common situation.
Yeah.
So part of, I think, why no episiotomy has become like a resounding call on birth plans in general is because routine episiotomy did used to be done.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So previously it was felt that that was actually in the patient's best interest, in the best interest of a safe delivery, was to make a cut, especially for a first-time mom, to allow baby to be delivered a little bit more easily.
Yeah.
But now we have actually found, you know, over the last 10, 20, 30 years, as we've increasingly done better quality studies on you know, female-bodied patients and on labor and delivery in general, is that routine use of episiotomy, so when it's done for every person for no reason, does increase the risk of severe tears, so into the muscles surrounding the bum, as well as pelvic floor issues like pain.
Yeah.
However, there are certainly times in which the evidence supports episiotomy. And again, when like I would think any provider would probably recommend one.
Yeah.
So again, routine use, not recommended.
Yeah.
Not recommended, not backed up by evidence. Increased risk of things like surgical repair needs, perineal pain, pain with sex, all of that kind of thing. However, selective episiotomy is still very much supported in the literature. And this is in the interest of decreasing those things as well.
Yeah.
So
like
some
severe tears and stuff like that.
Exactly. So some situations where the evidence is in support of episiotomy, first and foremost, is for operative vaginal delivery. So forceps or vacuums in women who have not had a baby before. Mm-hmm. Okay. Especially with things like prolonged second stage or high risk situations which feel high risk for perineal trauma.
Yeah.
So just practically some things that I would think would be high risk for perineal trauma outside of like medical conditions with the patient would be if the perineal body is very short.
Short.
So if the distance between the vagina and the bum is very short, then I worry that a tear is going to, especially if I'm using instruments which are larger diameter to help your baby out, that a tear is going to tear straight through down into those muscles.
Yes.
And or if the perineal body is very swollen after pushing for a long period of time, then that also makes the risk of tear a little more likely.
How, in your experience, is that common? Like, is it common for people to have a short perineum, or is it?
It's common enough in the sense that like everybody's body is different.
It's just different. Yeah. Like it's hard to say. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But even then I will say like the evidence is in support of that in a selective patient-centered way, right? So I do not do an episiotomy for every forceps or vacuum I do. I do not do it every time I see a short perineal body. There have been, though, in select patients and patients where that seems like it's going to be the case, there have been multiple large observational studies as well as meta-analyses and randomized control trials that demonstrate that doing a mediolateral episiotomy significantly reduces the incidence of obstetrical anal sphincter injury, so injury to the muscles surrounding the bum, in first-time parents undergoing an operative vaginal delivery. And the risk reduction can range from 43 to 68% for vacuum and forcep deliveries, respectively.
And trust me, you do not want a third or fourth degree tear. Like if we can avoid it, we should do it.
No, exactly. Exactly. And mediolateral, I think, is the important word to use here too, which means that we don't cut the tear directly down.
Yep.
We actually make a tiny incision. So the not side. Very big at all, kind of to like 6, 7, 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
So, right?
Yeah.
On the perineal body itself.
Yes.
And again, the way that I explain this to people sometimes is if you can imagine like tearing a piece of paper, just taking two sides of it and tearing down, the tear is going to go kind of all jagged. Oh, I ran into our microphone. The tear is going to go all jagged all throughout.
Yes.
But if you fold it a bunch of times and then you tear it, the tear is going to go where you want it to go.
Yes.
And so the idea is that by making a small incision, we're not actually like cutting open the perineal body.
No.
We're just kind of making a few centimeter incision in the interest of directing the tear away from the bum.
Yeah.
The other thing that sometimes necessitates or where an episiotomy is sometimes helpful mm-hmm. is in the cases of something like a shoulder dystocia yep. or fetal distress.
Yeah.
Right?
We need to get baby out quicker.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think a common misconception is that the episiotomy for shoulder dystocia is to create more room for baby.
Yeah.
Or to relieve the shoulder dystocia, the shoulder being stuck. Not, it's actually not. It's so that we can reach in to help baby get unstuck.
Yeah. Provides you a little bit more room to do your emergency maneuvers.
Exactly. Exactly. So these are the cases in
these are the big scaries, yeah. the ones that we will keep in mind.
Yeah.
But when we see a no episiotomy sign on your birth plan, yeah. this is when we start to think, oh, but what if?
Yeah.
Again, we don't want to have these conversations with you, but yeah. these are the things that as providers, you have to think yeah. about. Well, or you have to anticipate potentially yeah. those things happening and what yeah. you're going to do about them. Yeah. And one of those things is an episiotomy,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that's where the pushback, I guess we can say, comes mm-hmm. from the no episiotomy
yeah.
symbol on your birth yeah. plans. It's just yeah. because you want to be able to make sure baby gets here safely
yeah.
and also that you're avoiding those severe tears that go into your anal sphincter, yeah. which are no fun. If yeah. we can prevent them, may as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think ultimately the messaging at the end of the episiotomy thought process really is that, you know, first and foremost, routine episiotomy, not recommended, not supported by evidence,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And I can't speak for every obstetrical provider, but I can say the vast majority of those that I have worked with, yep. I think actually everyone that I've worked with
yep.
Does not do routine episiotomy.
No, same here.
Although I can't speak for everyone, right? Yeah. And so voicing that you only want an episiotomy when medically necessary, if that is, you know, what you want, is very reasonable still.
Completely.
Right?
Yep.
But rest assured that I would hazard a guess, at least, you know, in Canada, that is the overwhelming experience that you would have, is that the times when we are recommending episiotomy
yeah.
would be when we do think it is in the best interest of reducing risk of other more concerning Absolutely. Things.
Yep. I love that, what you said. Mm-hmm. Episiotomy when medically necessary. That's
exactly.
what I would have on my birth plan if I yeah. was making a birth plan.
And that's what's supported by our societies. That's what's yeah. supported by our evidence, right?
Totally.
Is restrictive use of episiotomy, reserving it only for cases where it is medically necessary,
yeah.
knowing that when we control for those factors in the literature, that it then flips, right?
Yes.
The outcomes flip from... Mm-hmm. prompting, you know, more severe tears, more pain, all of that kind of thing, to preventing it,
yes.
right? And finding that balance is challenging, but that's what ultimately you and your provider will be trying to do together,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Now, the next one that I want to discuss is yes. delayed cord clamping.
Yes, that's a huge one. I mean, again, most hospitals do a minimum of 60 seconds of delayed
yeah.
cord clamping. That's actually best practice nowadays.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we see a lot of other things on birth plans. I've seen before, you know, oh, don't cut the cord until it stops pulsating and mm-hmm. it's completely white.
Yeah.
And what else have I seen? People saying 5 minutes of delayed cord clamping wait until the placenta is delivered.
Yeah.
I think that's called a lotus birth. I mm-hmm. think I've heard. Which, I mean...
A lotus birth, I think, is when you don't cut it, when you let it fall off naturally.
Oh, like it completely just stays
yeah.
on for however
yeah.
long it takes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. See, yeah. I don't even know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe we need to do a little mini episode on lotus birth.
On lotus birth. Well, listen, I think the takeaway point here, let's start with the thing that we can all agree on,
yes.
right? Some form of delayed cord clamping
is beneficial.
Is beneficial, yeah. right? It increases newborn hemoglobin.
Mm-hmm.
It increases iron stores and it decreases the rates of infant anemia. Mm-hmm. This is especially helpful for preterm babies.
Mm-hmm.
It does somewhat increase the rate of neonatal jaundice, but
yes.
not necessarily of bad outcomes from neonatal jaundice.
Yeah, yeah.
We can all kind of agree, I think, that some form of delayed cord clamping usually is helpful to some extent, and probably the best benefit is for premature babies.
Yes.
But I think the how long, right?
Yeah.
At like what point do the benefits start to fall off, right? Mm-hmm. And do risk of other things like infection or other mm-hmm. concerns start to take place, right? Mm-hmm. What are the circumstances that will help us to kind of add some nuance to this discussion,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, nothing in medicine, nothing in health in general is simple, right? No. Nothing is as simple as just like, oh, you do this thing and it's always good.
Yeah.
Nothing is
it's
always
not black
good.
And white.
Right? And so I think, again, most reasonable people would agree yeah. that there surely is a time when the delay is no longer helpful,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And I think that's something that we're still starting to figure out. So there is actually a new ACOG clinical practice update that mm-hmm. just came out this month, I think, 2025,
yeah.
That adds a little bit of nuance to this. So as you said, Sid, about a minute, 60 seconds usually, or 30 seconds to 60 seconds of delayed cord clamping is standard of care in most hospitals.
Yeah.
Most places are happy to do this for a term baby.
Yeah.
But it certainly is recommended, and I think we very intentionally wait 60 seconds for premature babies as well, because that is yeah. really where the best benefit lies and where the evidence is most in favor yes. of delaying cord clamping.
And just to also clarify, mm-hmm. we can do delayed cord clamping with a C-section as well.
Yeah,
I think a absolutely. Lot of people think that you can't, but we absolutely yeah. can and do. Yeah. I do 60 seconds of yeah. delayed cord clamping yeah. with yeah. all of my C-sections,
yeah.
majority.
Yeah.
The only time we can't yeah. is, again, if the newborn's state of health at that particular time needs further resuscitation or yeah. something, and yeah. we need to cut the cord sooner yeah. so that we can provide those emergency resuscitation
yeah.
measures.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that is, I think, the caveat here as well, mm-hmm. right? And again, something that most people would agree on is if your baby is needing help to breathe, if yeah. your baby is needing help to have their heart rate be high enough to sustain their circulation,
yeah.
which are some of the main things that we worry about in deliveries, right?
Yeah.
Then I think most people would agree that obviously the benefits of the delaying extra time the cord. Of cord, like yeah. the modest decrease in anemia, the modest increase in hemoglobin and in iron stores, those are like long-term benefits, short long-term benefits.
Yes.
They're not immediate benefits. Obviously, your baby breathing is a much
breathing,
more urgent
crying,
need.
Heart rate
right?
is good. Those are-
Exactly. Yeah. So if baby is not vigorous, right?
Yes.
If baby is in need of additional resuscitation,
yep.
the evidence is clear that we should be clamping that cord and handing them off to the respiratory therapists and pediatricians that are going to be able to support your baby in a more acutely important way.
Exactly.
Right? Now, above 37 weeks or term, we would have a much lower threshold to do this, right? Because again, mm-hmm. the benefit of delayed cord clamping is much more modest in this population, mm-hmm. although present, right?
Yeah.
And so that would be like an easy, if baby's not looking well, then again, yes. I think we have a lower threshold to say, let's just clamp the cord yeah. and baby over because the benefit is less significant.
Exactly.
Now a preterm baby, certainly again, the benefit is there. And we are actually finding this new ACOG practice update did show that delayed cord clamping lowers, mortality, before discharge, compared with immediate clamping. And long deferrals, so greater than 2 minutes, potentially shows an even larger mortality reduction. Mm. Now, these numbers are very small, right? Mm-hmm. The risk of a baby passing away, especially a baby without other concerning issues, mm-hmm. Is very, very low before mm-hmm. delivery. But I think that is an important nuance to kind of describe.
Yeah.
What do we do for these babies that are less than 37 weeks for which we may need both resuscitation, but we yeah. also want to give them the benefit of that decrease in mortality risk, right?
Yeah.
As well as the increase in hemoglobin and iron and all of that yeah. kind of thing.
Yeah.
So in a baby that needs resuscitation, right? Or that needs to be handed off to pediatricians for which we don't think we can get the 60 seconds, much less the 120 seconds,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
What is now suggested is that if they are between 32 weeks and 37 weeks, we can milk the cord.
Mm-hmm.
So we can hold on to it and push blood 2 to 3 times into baby, to give baby a little transfusion. And that mm-hmm. is actually as well shown to have an overall hematologic benefit in preterm infants.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily, at least in the studies as we have them now, increase their mortality rates mm-hmm. or improve their mortality rates, but it does increase their hematologic outcomes. So yeah. the hemoglobin, the iron, and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's linked to lower transfusion rates. Now, below 32 weeks, mm-hmm. milking the cord and that pressure of yeah. pushing extra blood into baby actually is shown to increase the rate of intraventricular hemorrhage.
Yeah.
So that is a bleed in the brain for those babies for whom their arteries are just, they're and smaller, their veins are just so thin delicate. And delicate, right?
Yeah.
So below 28 weeks, I believe, we do not recommend
milking
the umbilical cord. Mm-hmm. So 28 to 37 weeks.
Yeah.
We can milk the cord 2 to 3 times. Below 28 weeks, that's no milking of the cord.
Yeah.
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 And again, I think this is the element that remains to be seen a little bit. As previously we thought that 60 seconds was kind of the sweet spot.
Yeah.
Now we're seeing that potentially there's benefit up to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But those studies are fairly small,
yeah,
to be honest. And before we're able to recommend change, I think it is important to see whether there is more nuance available.
More evidence. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. And that's kind of, you know, when people say, oh, I want the cord to be completely white and not pulsating anymore, mm-hmm, and all that kind of stuff. And it's right now, the current research states, mm-hmm, that, you know, 60 seconds,
yeah,
30 to 60 seconds,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
is effective in providing these,
yeah,
benefits.
Listen, more is not always better,
mm-hmm,
right? And that's, you know, I think if there's anything that these nuances that have been applied, particularly with respect to the role of milking the cord, shows, yes, us, mm-hmm, is that something that seems intuitively good, like, oh, more blood for baby,
yeah,
can actually cause more harm than good when, yeah, it's done without thought. And, yeah, so that would just be my caution to anyone who is looking to put something on their birth plan or do something with their delivery that is, that for which we don't have good evidence, mm-hmm, for, is, mm-hmm, is that while there, you might be right, right? There may be some additional benefit to longer delayed cord clamping. There, yeah, may also be harm,
yes,
right? Mm-hmm. And this is an evolving area of medicine, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, for which we are understanding more and more every day. And so,
yeah,
I would just caution people that you must, while you are, I'm sure, while people are, I'm sure, very happy to accept the possible benefit,
yeah,
you also must be prepared to accept the harm, mm-hmm, right? If it's something that we're not able to fully evaluate.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. The last one, let's quickly touch on, mm-hmm, if you guys are loving us, like going through these individually, like everything you would have on a birth plan, let us know. We can do another episode, yeah, going through everything. Like, it's just, we can't possibly touch on everything. There's so many things. So we just chose a couple main points that we, yeah, wanted to get across. But, the last one is the golden hour. So the skin to skin, which I personally is like one of my favorite. I actually wanted to name the podcast the golden hour,
but there already is a golden hour.
We couldn't grab it, but I actually thought that would be such a cute name for the podcast. Yeah,
you did say you always had that at the back of your mind.
Yes.
And listen, to end on that beautiful note as,
yeah,
well,
yeah,
something that, like, I see golden hour on everybody's birth plans,
yes,
too. I think it's like ubiquitous with birth plans. It's like the most common thing that I see,
yeah,
outside of no episiotomy.
Yes.
but what's really lovely is that there have been some really great studies that have looked at the impact of, mm-hmm, of the golden hour, right? Mm-hmm. Something, again, we intuitively want to do, I think, when, yes, you deliver your baby.
Yeah.
So again, this is skin to skin contact for mom and for baby during that first hour after delivery.
Yeah.
The first benefit that it has is it has really good evidence for promoting breastfeeding, which, yeah, is, if you've listened to our breastfeeding episode, certainly has benefits for mom and, yes, baby, right?
Yes.
So it increases the likelihood of breastfeeding even at 1 to 4 months post-birth, being able to do that, oh, 1 hour of skin-to-skin contact.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it also improves breastfeeding effectiveness and duration. A really strong neonatal benefit as well is in physiologic stability after, mm-hmm, birth. Mm-hmm. So skin-to-skin contact supports nomothermia. So the baby being able to thermoregulate, not being too cold,
yeah,
after delivery,
yeah,
and stabilizes their cardiorespiratory output.
Yeah.
It increases neonatal blood glucose levels and reduces the risk of hypoglycemia significantly in studies.
Which is just amazing. Like, skin-to-skin is magical,
right? Like, it's this really natural thing that we do that has all of these really real physiologic effects.
Yes.
It also decreases neonatal stress and supports transition to the outside world.
Yeah.
And it's associated with reduced admissions to the neonatal ICU for hypoglycemia, as well as shorter overall hospital stays.
Yes.
So these benefits as well are supported across vaginal and cesarean births.
Yeah.
And the evidence supports routine implementation of skin-to-skin afterwards, which I think, again, is present in most Canadian hospitals.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly the World Health Organization, UNICEF, as well as the American Heart Association have highlighted its importance in the post-delivery
time. Which is why it's being implemented so much in routine care, I will say. Like, I think when I was in nursing school, it wasn't being implemented as much.
Yeah.
But now, like 5 years later, it is routine based off of obviously your health status at the time and babies.
Yeah.
But we try to do skin to skin pretty immediately after birth if that's something that you want.
Yeah. Now, I think the reframing though that needs to happen with this like otherwise incontrovertibly positive thing is that sometimes skin to skin is not possible.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
If mom needs support or if baby needs support afterwards, obviously, you know, more acute health issues may take priority to providing that skin-to-skin hour and that golden hour of contact.
Like anything, risks versus benefits and all that kind of stuff.
And
right?
again, I have yet in my practice to have a parent who would not prioritize, you know, their life or their baby's life over skin-to-skin. But what I do find, so I'm not getting refusal, at least in my experience, but I have seen a lot of disappointment and grief and feelings of not having been able to provide that benefit to baby if skin-to-skin was not possible.
Yeah.
And I think what's important to highlight as well is skin-to-skin later still has benefits
benefits.
So you do not lose all of the potential benefits that we've just outlined by not doing it in that first hour. That first hour is best studied and probably has the most significant impact.
Yep.
But there is absolutely benefit to, you know, engaging in skin to skin afterwards.
Yes. And with the birthing person is obviously the first person we would like, just especially right immediately postpartum, but it can be done with other someone else as partners, well.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So Sid,
yes.
As we wrap up this episode, where really we could ramble forever about.
We could keep going. There's so many aspects we could get into.
There's so many things to consider.
Yeah.
Do you have kind of like a few key points that you would want people to take into consideration as they're engaging in the process of making a birth plan?
Yeah. So I think number one things I want you to take away is keep your birth plan short, simple, sweet, make sure it's concise, and also has like 3 to 4 of your non-negotiables on there. So figure out, sit down with your partner, whoever is going to be with you during the birth, and figure out what those most important aspects that you want to be included on the birth plan are, and that the person who's with you knows what they are as well, so that they can advocate for you. And then try to think of your birth plan as more of a preference list, not completely a guide of exactly what's going to happen, a plan of the because it's not going to go exactly to plan. It's really not. It's just one of those things that, as you said, birth is inherently unpredictable.
Yeah.
And we will try our very best to incorporate your most important aspects into your birth as much as we can, but just know that it's okay if it doesn't 100% go to plan as well.
Yeah. You know, the loss of control, I think, is, again, one of the scariest things in approaching something like birth. And I think using the birth plan as an educational tool, as an introduction to the birthing process, while allowing for nuance and contingencies, gives us the opportunity to kind of balance that autonomy that it provides with safety, right? And mitigating some of these concerns about disappointment and grief if your birth does not go in the way that you envisioned it,
It would.
I think having a sense of what is to be expected while maybe keeping that vision blurry a little bit from the perspective of both safety and from overall wellness is perhaps something that is most beneficial to the majority of people going through a birth.
Exactly. And then if you guys are interested, I do have a birth plan template as well. That it's like a downloadable PDF and that I've laid out with all what I think is the most important aspects to have on a birth plan. You guys can check that out on my website, www.nursesydney.com. And, but again, you don't have to use that. Some hospitals actually have birth plan templates that you can use as well. And it also can just be a piece of paper with your preferences listed out on it. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. But some people like to have a guide. So I like to mention that as well, but
I think that's great.
Yeah.
My last thing that I'd like to say to everybody with respect to birth plans is to kind of like reclaim this idea that we say as providers a lot, and I'm guilty of it. We say it to each other. I'm sure I said this with respect to my own delivery.
Yeah.
I'd like to issue a revision of our statement previously that the best birth plan is a healthy mom and a healthy baby.
Yeah.
I think as opposed to saying that with this mindset of not either or, but and, I think the best birth plan has flexibility baked in, right?
Yep.
And I think really that is what, that is where the middle ground lies with all of this.
Yep.
So listen, let us know about your own birth plans. What went right? What went wrong? What would you do differently if you had the opportunity to do it again?
Yeah.
Did you use one? Did you find it helpful?
Yeah. And a lot of people forget to prepare for the unexpected too. So include that in there too.
Yeah.
Let us know if preparing for the unexpected was helpful.
Yeah.
Did you find it helpful or did it just overwhelm you?
Yeah.
And again, it can do that as well.
Totally. And we could have gone through every single element in a birth plan in detail. We just kind of picked the ones that were most interesting to us and most relevant to our team. But tell us what you would like to know more about. Are there any aspects of the birth plan that you want to know more information on?
Yes.
You can follow us and reach out on our social media. On Instagram, we're at the.push.pod.
Yeah, or you can email us at askthepushpod@gmail.com. So let us know. We want to hear from you guys.
And we will see you next time.
Thank you. Bye.